Is the idea that British intelligence would be behind these bombings gaining any traction in Britain? And I'm speaking of the work of, an individual like Frank Kitson in, with the Mau Mau and the pseudo gangs. And is that idea gaining any traction in, Britain as the whole 911 movement has here?
Okay, just to explain to folks who might not know about the reference to Frank Kitson. Frank Kitson was a very highly regarded military theorist in Britain in the 1970s. And he wrote a book, wrote a couple of books, about, one of them was called Low Intensity Operations, and one, I think one of them was called Games and Countergames. And one of the things that he had done during Britain's colonial wars in the 50s and 60s was he had formed units which were mimicking the way that the Mau Mau guerrillas in Kenya, for example, dressed and operated the weapons they carried and so on. And they would go and carry out actions and try and infiltrate areas disguised as guerrillas. And then they could do stuff which could be blamed on guerrillas and so on. So that's the kind of background of counter gangs. And so this is an established technique of British military strategy in counterinsurgency. So that's where that thing is coming from. In terms of whether the idea that British intelligence might have organized the 7/7 attacks is gaining credence in Britain, across the general public, I don't have a clear picture, but my impression is probably not. In the anti-war movement, I think that there is a substantial minority of people who hold to that view, and I don't know whether it's increasing or declining, to be honest, but there's a substantial minority of people who hold to that view.
I was going to say, I think it's pretty clear that why Muslims and Arabs would be upset with American foreign policy. I have no trouble connecting that to any action. However, I'd like to know what evidence there is that Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda had really anything to do with 9/11. Where's the evidence? I mean, there's the government story, but there's, to my knowledge anyway, there's never been any evidence other than their word. So why would you say that this was an action perpetrated by a foreign policy, for instance? We don't really know who perpetrated it or how or why.
Well, I think there's plenty of evidence that the essentials, if not all of the details, of the standard picture of the Al-Qaeda operation, like the planes operation against New York and Washington and Flight 93, stand up. I think there's plenty of evidence, including the video statements left behind by some of the bombers. And I think that, you know, if you're saying, can it be proven beyond reasonable doubt that Osama bin Laden carried out these attacks, then in a court of law, maybe the evidence doesn't stack up that strongly. But the plain fact is that the Al-Qaeda core, which is Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri and, you know, several dozen other people around them, they have been arguing for a very long time. They're a minority within the kind of jihadist movement in the world. If I could just back up a little bit, most Islamic fundamentalists are not violent. Most Islamic fundamentalists in the world are in seclusion from what they regard as the fallen world, whether it's a Muslim society or Western society. They're forming little enclaves within which they can have the right society. And so most Islamic fundamentalists are not violent. There are violent Islamic fundamentalists, and for shorthand you can call it jihadists, even though, as I'm sure everyone here knows, the word jihad does not just mean military action or violence. It just means struggle and you can have spiritual jihad and, you know, all kinds of, there's lots to say about that. We'll call it jihadist because for shorthand. Within the jihadist movement are people who believe that violence is necessary under present world conditions in accordance with Islam, to defend Islam. The Al-Qaeda strand is a minority strand within that, and there's a guy called Fawaz Gerges, G-E-R-G-E-S, who's written a couple of books. One of them is called Far Enemy, which is precisely about this debate. And what he's saying is, the majority of jihadists believe and have focused their energies on fighting what's called the near enemy. So Egyptian jihadists organize to take on the Egyptian government and so on. And so that's the focus of most people who are involved in jihad. And Bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, who changed his mind and switched over to this way of thinking after being a big advocate of near enemy strategy, they are a minority strand, and they've kind of hijacked the movement in the sense of gaining the international prominence and gaining the attention of Muslims around the world and of the Western world and so on. So that when we talk about jihadists, we think about Al-Qaeda slash jihadism. And the Al-Qaeda argument, which Bin Laden has been putting forward for very many years, is in order to defeat the near enemy, we have to take on the foreign, i.e. the people who are behind, the people who are local. There's no point in trying to take on and defeat the Egyptian government, because they're too strong, because they're backed up by the US. We've got to get the US to back off from the Middle East, and then we're going to have a chance of taking down the near enemy. So, Bin Laden has been saying for a very long time, what we've got to do is we've got to attack the West and get them to back off. And most of the jihadist movement has regarded that as a complete cul-de-sac, dead-end, suicidal strategy. And their warnings have, to some extent, been borne out by what's happened since 9/11 in particular. So, the Bin Laden message, which was, you know, was coming out well before 9/11, perfectly fitted with the attacks which, you know, he acknowledged responsibility for in terms of the East Africa embassy attacks, and in that video which was shot by an acolyte, where he makes that remark in passing about, I had the first idea for these attacks in Beirut when I was seeing the towers in Beirut being hit in 1982, which I think is probably baloney, that, you know, he had the idea back in 1982. When he was watching the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. But these kinds of assaults entirely fit in with Bin Laden's thinking, and of course he was very happy to say that the big assaults that happened, the big attacks like East Africa and so on, I'm happy to have incited these attacks. And that's how he's trying to portray himself. He's trying to portray the Al-Qaeda core as the inciter of young Muslims to carry out these attacks. However, as time goes by with each of the attacks, he's made less guarded statements, and he's made more of a frank admission about his role in things. So, you could say, quite rightly, well, the guy who is named in the 9/11 Commission report as the initiator and organizer of the planes operation is under US control somewhere in the world, we don't really know, and he, so the testimony that we have is entirely through the US government and so on, and therefore it's, you've got to have suspicions about that, and I completely accept that. And also, you could say, well, the testimony that he's giving, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, he plays a very big role in the whole thing, according to his own testimony, and there may be some kind of self-aggrandizing thing if it's a true account. If the essentials of it are correct, then probably he's kind of promoting his own role. He's making himself pretty much the center of the whole picture. So there are questions around it, but I think that the there's plenty of evidence that Osama bin Laden has been calling for this kind of stuff, and I think there's plenty of evidence about the people who have left messages behind, and I think there's some evidence about bin Laden's own admissions of guilt. So you can find out a plausible picture, or you can find out a not a plausible picture, but I think those are the kinds of evidence which are out there. So I think it's not true to say there's nothing out there to support that argument. There's some things out there. You can say it is insufficient, and that's your judgment. Or you can say, I think that's pretty reasonable, which is my judgment.
All right, let's see somebody else with a hand. You're scratching your head. Mm-hmm.
Hi, I wanted to ask a little bit about how much you've looked into the 19/11 hijackers and their background, and I'm curious how they compare with the London bombers. Because the one thing that strikes me that's obviously different is that the London bombers, when they grew up in Britain and that was their culture, and they're attacking, you know, where their friends could be on the subway, essentially, right? Whereas the 9/11 hijackers didn't primarily identify with the U.S., and so it's an other that you're attacking. And I'm wondering if there are other sort of differences or similarities or anything that struck you about those two groups.
You're the second person today to say, well, what about the 19 hijackers? And I haven't done a detailed study of it. What I would say in passing is that for the pilots, I think, occupied a similar kind of between two worlds position to these guys, because these guys grew up in Pakistani heritage communities in Britain, which have a particular brand of Islam, which is very secluded, quietistic, not politically engaged, pretty withdrawn, very much focused on the extended family. And the extended family is actually the unit around which the mosque is organized. And the Biradi, that's their name for the extended family in those parts of Pakistan. And so the focus is very much inward. And so what happens with this second generation is they're in a situation where they come from this quite inward-looking Muslim community with very strong peasant culture, which, you know, still manifested in their family relations to a large extent. And then they're having to negotiate, like a lot of people in the world, they're trying to negotiate between the culture of their parents and the culture of wider culture of Britain. And it's this negotiation of restrictions and freedom and family and community being important, but also wanting autonomy and so on. And on the one hand, wanting to have a little bit more freedom than you can have within the culture of your parents, but on the other hand, feeling rejected by white non-Muslim society, and all of those kinds of tensions, which, you know, I've got a bit about because there's quite a lot of interesting things to say about that. But I think that what I know about the pilots is that in a sense they were the functional equivalent of that. Not that their parents had moved to the West and they were the second generation, but many of them, I think all of them, were living in the West, and therefore they were negotiating the same stuff. And they were having the same, some of the same dilemmas of a restrictive, traditional, patriarchal culture at home, the lure of the other, and, you know, kind of German society and so on, and wider German society.
Wider German?
Yeah,
they were talking about German.
Yeah, they were living in Germany.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So some of those pressures are the same, which put you in a particular point of tension. And I think the thing about that particular point of tension is that it creates a pull towards fundamentalism. Not necessarily violent fundamentalism, but it creates a pull towards fundamentalism, because with fundamentalism, you are able to do a number of things which are valuable for self-esteem. One of them is, your parents want you to be a good Muslim, okay, but you don't want to be under the control of your parents. You can be a better Muslim than them, and say to them, you're a kind of a Sufi, you've got all these accretions to Islam, all these things which were picked up from these other societies which Islam has spread into. I'm going back to the real stuff. I'm going back to the book. I'm going back to the core. I'm going back to Muhammad, okay? And so you can be a rebel and a conformist at the same time, which is good. You can trace yourself and connect yourself to Muhammad and his companions and, you know, a kind of a golden age, and you can connect yourself to golden ages, which is good for your self-esteem. And you have a culture, you have an identity of resistance where in this kind of this tension between westernized non-Muslim identity and the traditional Muslim identity, you don't have to feel the pull and stuff. You've got something solid that you can just hold on to. So I think there are lots of attractions for someone in that situation to adopt that kind of persona. It resolves a lot of the open questions of being in that position, and it resolves some of those issues about authority and family relations and stuff like that. And I think that's an attraction towards that direction. But of course there are other ways of resolving that dilemma. And one of the options, which is also very widespread, is something which in Britain is called the kind of Ali G phenomenon, where instead you go for rap culture and hip-hop and you become this other solid identity which is different and resisting and so on. And I think a lot of the people, a lot of the young Muslims who are involved in the riots in France and so on, they've made that kind of a resolution. And there you have, again, in the riots in France, very much the same generational divide, where in Britain and in France, you have the older generation knuckling down, getting your head down to do the work, support your family, bring your family over, recreate your village society where you are, and then the next generation doesn't feel those connections, can't live in exactly the same world, and has got to do something else. And so I think those are two routes of resolution. And I think about the pious, obviously the bulk of the people involved in 9/11 came to Saudi Arabia, which is a different story. But for the pilots, they had some of those internal personal pressures, which I think are necessary for someone to be attracted to suicide terrorism, which are necessary to be distant from the actual struggle. Because most young Muslims who have felt this kinship with people who are suffering around the world, most of them have not been attracted to this kind of stuff. What they've done is, they've thought, my brothers are being killed, my sisters are being raped, I must defend them, I will go where that is happening. And that's what, in the book, I call solidarity jihad. You take supplies, maybe you take military supplies, maybe you pick up a gun and you fight alongside the people. You know, that just kind of makes natural sense. And that has been the majority response of young Muslims who feel that kinship, who are not in the sight of the oppression. They feel, I will go to the site of oppression, I will go to Bosnia, you know, I will go to Chechnya, I will go to Afghanistan, and I'll fight alongside my brothers and sisters in the struggle. So it's only a tiny fraction of the people who are separated from the struggle who are pulled in the direction of suicide terrorism. And I think that's partly because they are separated and they are feeling the desire the need to somehow make it all better. They're feeling, I am responsible. Back to standing room. Okay. They're feeling, I am responsible for all these Muslims around the world. And I know that nothing I do is really going to make a difference. You know, I can go to church, I can go wherever, I give my life, and people are going to carry on suffering. And I think it's that sense of impotence and powerlessness and humiliation in the face of Western power that is at the root of this, of, you know, being in this direction. So I think, you know, the only people who have been drawn to this stuff are people who have been separated from the actual sites of oppression. Because in the sites of oppression, you just take on whoever's doing the oppressing right now. You know, the people who are terrorizing my community, I'm going to fight them. So, you know, as has quite rightly been pointed out, a question does arise. Why, if Afghanistan, Iraq, and Palestine are the real drivers of this stuff, why aren't there Palestinians, Afghans, and Iraqis doing this stuff? Well, that's because they're taking on the person who's in the neighborhood who's doing this stuff and trying to protect their neighborhood. And it has to be someone distant who feels these feelings of powerless humiliation and, I think, over-responsibility. So finally, never expected this answer would be so long, I'm sure. Finally, what I'll say is that there is a thing which suicide research is called the ambivalence of someone who's in a suicidal frame of mind, where you think two completely opposite things at the same time. What I think about these guys is that I think they were thinking two completely different things at the same time. One of which was, I am dishonored by the suffering that's going on in the world, which I cannot solve and therefore save all of my brothers and sisters. I am unworthy. I am worthless. I am powerless. I don't deserve to exist. And therefore, I find myself radically unacceptable, and therefore I don't deserve to exist. And while I berate myself, I'm also going to take out some of the other people who don't care, don't know, aren't doing enough. Thinking that on the one hand, and thinking that simultaneously on the other hand, I am an instrument of God. I am changing the world with this atrocity, with this apocalyptic act. I'm going to move history, and I'm going to make this enormous difference to the world. And I think both of those things are happening at the same time. And so we're familiar with this, with the phenomenon of suicide homicide, which is what this is. Because, I mean, suicide bombings could be just military, you know, against military, but what we're talking about is suicide attacks against civilians. We're familiar with the concept of suicide homicide from, you know, we read about it in the papers every week. Someone kills their girlfriend or something like that, and then they kill themselves. Now, what I think happens there is someone judges someone else as radically unacceptable. They erase them, and then they have to judge themselves. And they find themselves radically unacceptable for what they've just done. I think that the dynamic of these things is the other way around for the key people, which is, I am radically unacceptable, I cannot live up to my obligations, and therefore I must be erased, and while I'm erasing myself, I'm going to erase some of you unacceptable people as well. So, I think that's the longest answer of the evening, because we don't have more time to do such long answers.
I have two items, I guess. One is, I've read that in Britain, before the Iraq War and into it, that 75-80% of the people polled were against it. And I'm wondering, are they still that way?
Okay, just on that, yeah. What happened was, before the war, we had, like, lots of opinion polls showing some, well, let's say, between 50% and two-thirds of people against the war. As soon as the war started, that would drop right down. And then after the war, after a while, after the end of major combat operations, or the declaration that we are now entering the phase of occupation, after a while of that, the opposition has been creeping up. So it's now about the same level as it was pre-war. So the second thing was?
And I've read in London's Freedom Fortnightly that you've been involved in. I got that you're late, so maybe you already talked about this, but you were involved with Voices in the Wilderness that brought medical supplies and other supplies in Iraq before the war illegally, and that you were being prosecuted for it. What's going on with that?
Well, what happened was in 1998, I did that, and I was arrested for it, and I was threatened with prosecution, for which the maximum penalty was 5 years, and then after a while, they decided not to carry on the prosecution. What's happening right now is that there was, Dan referred to this thing at the beginning, which was as part of an international initiative which was kind of co-sponsored by my group, Justice on Vengeance and Voices for Creating a Violence in Chicago. Myself and Maya Evans, who's my co-worker in Justice on Vengeance, we were reading out the names of people who died in Iraq or outside Downing Street. And there's a new law which says in the area around Parliament and Capitol, applying writing for permission from the police to hold any kind of an event. And we decided that we weren't going to do that, and so got arrested. And Maya was prosecuted, and she became the first person to be convicted of participating in an unauthorized demonstration. And I got arrested and prosecuted for being the first person to be prosecuted for organizing an unauthorized demonstration. And so we both got convicted and we both got fines and neither of us are paying, so when I go back probably they'll, you know, they'll call me back to court and we'll have some more discussion about that.
I was brought up in London, and when I was young I saw the different communities, the Pakistani communities, the West Indian. And I left when I was quite young too, I left England and travelled around. And but what you were saying about the second generation, because what I saw was a different kind of racism, it's different from what you're saying, because there's like two or three generations of people that came from Commonwealth countries that were British and went to Britain. But I went to Bosnia during the war, and I was there, the last part of the war when it was under siege. And then I went back after, and the young men, because we had a peace center there, and the young men I was working with were now going to jihad, which they never really explained, but it was always the young men, and there were more women that were wearing veils than there were before. So in a way, it feels that there was also that, what you were talking, Morris, talking about things in that way. Can you see what connection I tried to make? That they, you know, they before weren't going to be schooled on jihad, and they were going to whoever, they never told me who, because I was living in the same house as one of the young men. And all these young boys that I was teaching English and doing things with were going to these other meetings, and had changed. They changed the way they were. They seem very different in the outlook. And maybe, you know, there's a connection worldwide in that way.
I'm sure you're right.
Okay. Any more questions? I guess Tim.
I mean, I came late, so pardon me if this has been covered, but I heard you on the radio a couple times, so I'm somewhat familiar with where you're coming from, and I guess I was just curious what your response was to the history of staged bombings in Europe. I'm thinking about the Red Brigades in Italy that were accused of train bombing that turned out to be grabbing fascists. The bombings in Spain were initially ETA was blamed, and then it switched to Islamists. 9/11 is not clear in many people's minds as an era of atrocity. And actually, a lot of the stuff I've been reading about 7/7 bombings suggests that these men may have been set up and that there's reason to believe that Secret Services were involved.
I haven't. I mean, I've looked into the whole 7-7 thing a lot, and I haven't seen evidence myself that would support that interpretation. So, you know, there are claims being made, but I haven't personally seen stuff that is convinced me. Maybe I haven't seen everything, but that's my conclusion so far. Incidentally, just as a passing thing, I find, I'm not getting at you, because this is universal practice, but
right.
I find this word Islamist really troubling, because it's the word which the violent Islamic fundamentalists, the Islamic right, invented for themselves. And what they're saying is, we represent the essence of Islam. We are the Islamists, right? And so my friends who are Islamic pacifists, they don't get to call themselves Islamists, right? Why is it that when a Christian nutcase is trying to impose the Old Testament on Uganda, terrorizes the region, he isn't called a Christianist, you know? But when Osama bin Laden and co. spout threats against the world and organized stuff, they're called Islamists. I'm not getting at you for...
Anyone
here could have used it. You know, anyone here could have used it. And it's in the papers, and Chomsky used it in his book, and everything like that. But I have a real problem with that word, because we're giving ground to these people when we use the word. They invented the word for themselves to say, we are the essence. And I don't think we should give that ground to them. They're part of the Muslim community. They have one of the interpretations of Islam. But there are so many interpretations, there are so many strands, that I think that, you see, I think it's, I'm, as I said before, I'm not a Muslim, I come from a Hindu background. I think it's terribly hard for us Western non-Muslims to talk about Islam in a rational way, because we've got centuries of fear and hatred, which is affecting our language, our way of thinking, our perception of the Quran, and so on. I mean, one of the things that I hadn't realized until I was researching this book, I think Dan is sending me telepathic vibrations at this point, is that, for example, Muhammad, for 13 years, he was living in Mecca when he was building up his congregation, after he'd had his first revelation, he was persecuted, and his followers were persecuted. They were insulted, they were harassed, they were beaten up, they were threatened, and Muhammad, for those 13 years, which I think is about four times longer than Jesus' ministry, for those 13 years, he himself was a model of non-violent resistance, and he enjoined his followers not to respond violently, and in the end he had to send them away from Mecca, and in the end he had to flee when a mob came after him. And that's the dividing point, when instead of being a spiritual teacher, he then became a political and by necessity a military leader. Either they were going to allow the Meccans to wipe them out, which is what the Meccans wanted to do. The Meccans came after them to Medina. Or they were going to fight back. And that's the turning point. Now you can say that was good or that was bad or whatever. But why is it that we only hear about and read about and perceive the phase of Muhammad, the political and military leader, of the lawgiver and the conqueror, which he was, and there is no attention to his period as, a non-violent resistor. Now, the picture has got everything in it. I don't understand people who say Islam is a religion of peace. I don't think any religion, major religion, is a religion of anything. You find different strands in it, But within the example of Muhammad, within the teachings of Muhammad, you find non-violent strands, and you find violent strands. But why is it that we have no awareness even of the non-violent strands, of the non-violent parts of the Quran, about the non-violent parts of Muhammad's practice, and even after he becomes a political and military leader, by the way, the decisive event in his return to Mecca, eventually, and taking control of it, is when he leads a virtually unarmed group of his followers back to Mecca during the pilgrimage season, when, you're forbidden to use force during that sacred month. But he's putting the lives of his entire community in the hands of the Meccans. And they actually come out to try and get the Muslims, but they go to the wrong place or whatever. And because of that, and because of a negotiation he enters into with the Meccans, that he will be allowed to come back the next year, that is the turning point. That, I think it's kind of like Gandhi, to be honest. I mean, they were wearing these short hunting swords, but they, you know, if the Meccans had wanted to wipe them out, they could have been wiped out. It's sort of like Gandhi putting his community into the hands of the Meccans, negotiating, doing a deal which his followers thought was a sellout, going back to Medina and coming back the next year. And the next year they came back, well, they actually did come back armed the next year, but under the terms of this agreement. And they just walked into Mecca, there was no fighting, and they took over, and that was the start of the Muslim Empire. But, you see, even at that moment, it was putting himself into the hands of the enemy and negotiating that was this fulcrum thing. I'm not saying Muhammad was a pacifist. I'm not saying Muhammad taught peace. But there are elements there which I think we should appreciate, and which I know Muslims who look to those as their inspiration, and who, you know, who are devoted to non-violence, because they take those strands out of it. So that was a big riff off one word that you said in the course of another question. But
we're losing daylight.
We're losing daylight, and we're probably also losing patience. So I